Hey y'all, I'm Carrie.
Hey y'all, I'm Mandy.
And this is Monstrous.
This episode contains topics and language that may not be suitable for all listeners, and topics that may be triggering for some. Listener discretion is advised.
Okay. All right. Are we ready?
We're ready.
All right. Okay, so I wanted to do an older case and then one that would go with Easter that's coming up in a couple weeks. So in my search, I found both an old one and an interesting one.
Nice.
And I don't think the way that I have it written, I don't think you're going to see the ending coming, but we'll see. So are you ready to dive in to today's case about Veronica Gideon and the Easter Sunday murders?
Let's see.
Okay. So before we get into it, it is going to be a two-parter. All right. So the 14th, which is, I think that's next week for us, is going to be part one. And then Monday after Easter is going to be part two. So our case begins with Mary and Joseph Gideon, which are Veronica's parents. Joseph Gideon left Hungary. A lot of people say it Hungary, but I'm pretty sure you're supposed to say it Hungary.
I didn't know that.
One of the two was right. It's either Hungary or Hungary. I think it just kind of depends on where you live, how you say it.
Right.
Anyway. So he left his home country in the early 1900s, moving to New York. Not long after arriving in the U.S., he met Mary Kuratowski. I believe that's how you say it. She, too, had immigrated from Hungary. She had actually immigrated around the same time that Joseph had. Once the two met, they bonded over their experience, their shared culture. And then after dating for some time, the two got married in 1908. Then moved to Astoria in Queens, which is in New York. A few years later, the couple welcomed their first of two daughters named Ethel. And then a few years later, in 1917, they welcomed their second daughter, Veronica, who went by Ronnie. So I'm going to call her Ronnie from this point forward. So that way there's no confusion. So both girls were said to be beautiful, but their personalities were vastly different. Ethel was always kind of stern. She was kind, but way more stern, while Ronnie was carefree and fun. So basically, Ethel was the good girl and Ronnie was the wild child. Since Joseph had arrived in the U.S., he hadn't really had any valuable skills. So early on in their marriage, he had relied on various odd jobs to provide for his family, which I feel like that's pretty common among immigrants.
Yeah.
They have to rely on odd jobs rather than a certain skill set because, you know, America expects everybody to be good at something. Anyway, so although these jobs were menial, the Gideons lived a pretty modest life. And after a few years of saving, the two were able to combine their savings along with the dowry that Mary had brought into the marriage with her, that they were able to put it all together and then purchase a home inside a rundown brownstone in Manhattan. First of all, could you imagine still having to have dowries?
Oh, I know. I didn't know they still did that.
That's how old this case is she had a dowry when they got married.
Right.
That's and crazy. As far as I know, I think some cultures still do it, but right. I think for the most part, it's kind of went out.
Yeah.
It's just crazy to me. Because even like here in the U.S. at one point, dowries were a thing.
Right.
But now they just kind of fizzled out. But I think some cultures might still do it.
They might.
Okay. So I'm really going to make myself sound stupid right now. Okay. Do you know what a brownstone is?
No.
Okay, it's not just me then. I'm good.
I would think brownstone would be something like cooking. No, that's blackstone. That's a blackstone. Never mind.
So I'm not a city girl. The biggest town that I've ever lived in had 28,000 people. So, you know, I'm not a city girl. So I had to look up what a brownstone was. I knew it was a type of house, but I had no idea what they looked like. So according to Google, it's a multi-story townhouse or row house with a brownstone facade. So I take the brownstone is like the type of brick it's made out of.
Yeah.
Is why it's called a brownstone. So you've watched SVU, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, of course. So you know those long buildings that look like they're separate homes, but they're like all connected?
Yeah.
Those are brownstones.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I know what you're talking about now.
Okay, I'm glad that it wasn't just me because I was like, I'm probably going to look so stupid.
We both do.
Okay. So the Gideons move into the first floor of the building on East 53rd Street. They go on to rent out the upstairs rooms to boarders. And for a little while, Joseph operated a speakeasy. I would love to walk into a 1900 speakeasy right now. It's like, even a speakeasy today would be awesome. But a speakeasy in the 1920s. Come on.
Right.
Like, you can't get any better than that. Okay. So Joseph operated the speakeasy out of the basement, but it was short-lived because local police had shut it down. Because, you know, it's the 1920s and prohibition. So now without the extra income from the speakeasy, Joseph was forced to go back to the only skill that he had ever really had and the one that he was good at. He opened up an upholstery shop just a few blocks from their apartment. In time, Joseph's business built up and provided financial security for the family. But things were not as good as they appeared to be behind closed doors. Their family life was full of chaos, conflict, and dysfunction. Like many men of Joseph's generation, he was a strict man and had a very rigid personality. Joseph saw little value in things in life like fun and social activities. He didn't see a purpose in any of it. He's like, what the hell is that for? He was like, no, we're not doing that, guys. Get a job and live your life, but you're not allowed to have fun.
Boring.
Yeah. So as far as he was concerned, the culture of his adopted country was too promiscuous. And he rallied against the, quote, rotten American system where children laugh at their parents and start running wild before they cut their teeth.
Hmm.
I feel like that's a little dramatic.
Yeah.
But again, he grew up in a different country with a completely different culture that we have in America. So you can't really fault him for that.
Right.
But those beliefs do not go well with two American-born daughters who were growing up in the time of jazz music, slang, social change, and of course, flappers. I want to be a 1920s flapper so bad. Like, I was born in the wrong era. I really was. Like, if I could go back to the 1920s to be a flapper, I might do it.
You'd be happy.
Yes. So, anyway. Okay, so his views and rigid personality caused a lot of tension in his relationships with his daughters, of course. Because like I said, his daughters were born here in America. They're being raised here in America. They had friends that were going out and doing all the normal things kids during that time did. And he hated it. So he didn't allow his daughters to do it. But Ronnie fought against her father's strict ways. She was stubborn and wild. Ronnie was said to be, quote, boy crazy, far more than her sister Ethel. But she was also the younger sister. And typically, the youngest is usually a little bit more rebellious than the older siblings. So,
yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I'm not really surprised by that.
Me neither.
This is a direct quote from Ronnie. She saw her father as, quote, spineless and irresponsible.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's safe to say those two did not have a very good relationship.
No, not at all.
So it seems at the time that Ronnie would go out of her way to defy him and to challenge him. She would stay out past curfew. She'd come home drunk, to which her father responded by using corporal punishment. So her father was physical with his daughters, which at the time it happened, like it was normal. Now, obviously, it's not, but it was then. So needless to say, Ronnie was desperate to escape her abusive, oppressive, and controlling father. This drove Ronnie to drop out of high school only 3.5 semesters in. Then she enrolled in beautician school, which we now call cosmetology. Her goal there was to become a hairdresser. But the Moeller Beautician Program, where she had attended school at, provided training in a wide range of subjects, all the way from hairstyling to scalp and skin disease treatment. So I did a little bit of everything. So this program proved to be too rigorous for Ronnie. She just wasn't what she thought it was going to be. So after 6 months, she quit. She sounds like a typical young adult.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't know what the fuck she wants to do with her life. So she's still young. Like I said, she has no idea what she wants to do. She just knew that she had to get out of her father's house. So a few years after this, in the spring of 1933, Ronnie was around 16. She again tried to get away from her parents. This time, she did it by marrying a man named Bobby Flowers. He was a family friend whose parents had owned a bowling alley within their neighborhood. No surprise, this teen marriage was a disaster, as most of them are. So after only a few months, around the beginning of 1934, the two had the marriage annulled, and Ronnie moved back into her parents' house. Although the marriage didn't work out, it seemed like this was the last act of defiance that Joseph would tolerate from his youngest daughter. But rather than kick her out of his house, he decided to leave the family.
Oh, shit.
So he left the house and told his friends that he was tired of the disobedience and tired of his wife always taking Ronnie's side rather than his.
Wow.
So Joseph packed a bag and he went to live in a small corner of his upholstery shop. So he's just like, I'm gonna throw a big old tantrum because my daughter doesn't want to live her life by my ways, which are strict and controlling. So he's like, I'm done with you ladies. I'm good. I'm out of here. I've had enough of you women. Done.
It's over. Bye.
Exactly. He did, though, maintain a relationship with his family. He just moved out. So I guess he didn't completely cut ties with them.
She did that.
Yeah. So the dynamic here with the Gideon family is pretty interesting. It's odd, but very interesting. It is the 30s, so who knows what the hell was going on in their heads, because America is just coming out of the Great Depression. So at this point, everything is crazy over here. So Joseph leaving the family would not be the only major change for the Gideons. Not long after her father moved out of the home, Ethel, who was coming out of her own brief teenage marriage, decided to start planning for her future, and she enrolled in Hunter College to attend secretarial classes. These classes led her to work at Vanity Fair, where she quickly rose through the ranks and eventually became the personal assistant secretary to Helen Norton, who was the magazine's editor at the time. Around this same time, she had met a man named Joe, who was a friend of the family and an inspiring lawyer. Before Ethel met Joe, she had a flirty relationship with one of her mother's boarders. She was young, and for Ethel, it was nothing more than just flirting. This man was an unemployed sculptor, and she didn't see him as a suitable husband, especially when he was compared to Joe. Okay, so it's the mid-30s, and back then, it wasn't really about love. It was more about who could provide a stable and well-off life. For Ethel, this boarder was not that. And so her flirty relationship with him stopped, and she began to see Joe. So after some time of dating, Ethel and Joe got married in June of 1936 at a small ceremony in Manhattan. So, of course, now Ethel moves out. She begins her married life with Joe. And with her now out of the house, the multifamily brownstone was way too big and too hard to manage for just Mary and Ronnie, who was now at this time back at home. So they moved from East 53rd Street to a much more affordable fourth floor walk-up apartment on East 50th Street. This apartment had three small bedrooms, a kitchen, and an open concept living and dining area. So it's a very tight, small living space. Despite this, though, Mary insisted on having a boarder to help pay the rent. For me, the cramped living space would be like, nope, not doing it. It's small. There's already two of us living here.
Right.
But Mary's like, I'm not paying for this shit by myself. Somebody's going to help me pay for it. And for Ronnie, it didn't really seem to bother her because her work and social schedules kept her out of the house most of the time. So it really seems like she went there to sleep and that was about it. So thanks to Ethel, Ronnie had made the acquaintance of a magazine publisher at Condone Nast. This publisher was taken with Ronnie's beauty and suggested that she model for his daughter, who is an aspiring artist. Ronnie didn't have a job at the time, so she's like, yeah, might as well. What else am I going to do? So within a few months of this meeting, Ronnie was a working model. She was posing for artists, photographers, and her most lucrative jobs were the ones where she posed for the lewd covers of those old-fashioned detective magazines.
Oh, nice.
You know which ones I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
Where there's a woman, like, up on a desk. She's got a leg, like, all propped up. And it's like...
Yeah.
You know? Okay, so by now, Ethel had moved out, and Joseph's relationship with his family was still very challenging. The Gideons, mainly Joseph and Mary, had made it a point to stay in contact, and they insisted that even though the family was not together, that they still get together on holidays. Not only this, but Joseph's upholstery shop had nowhere for him to bathe. So staying on good terms with his wife meant that he could use her place to bathe every couple weeks when his bathing routine at the shop weren't making the cut. Your face.
Huh.
Gotta remember, it's the 30s, okay? They didn't bathe every day back then.
Lord Jesus.
That's the only part of this era that I'm like, maybe I wasn't born during the wrong time.
Yeah, maybe not.
Okay, so in the early afternoon on March 28th, 1937, Joseph woke up late and he made his way over to the apartment that his wife and daughter lived in for Easter dinner. He was very eager to see everyone on that day because what his daughters did not know was that he and Mary had decided to get back together and reconcile their marriage, and they planned on telling their daughters at dinner. So Joseph arrived at the apartment around 2 p.m., getting there only a couple minutes after Ethel and her husband arrived. Joseph rang the bell for the apartment and waited to be buzzed in. But nothing happened. He was about to ring the bell again when someone leaving had held the door open for them to go inside. Not sure if his wife and daughter were home, he told Ethel and her husband to wait downstairs in the lobby while he went up to see if they were even there. Like, it's no point in you going up four flights of stairs if they're not home.
Right.
So Joseph climbed the four flights of stairs to their floor. He knocked on the apartment door, but no one answered. He tried the doorknob, which wasn't just unlocked, but actually slightly open. So once inside, he was greeted with an alarming sound. Tucci, which was Ronnie's Pekingese dog, came over to him acting very nervous and then crawled underneath the living room couch. So something wasn't right there.
Right.
So now we have three red flags waving all over the place.
Right.
So Mary knew that they were coming over for dinner. This wasn't just a last minute thing. She knew this. And at the very least, she would have been in the kitchen preparing for dinner. But Joseph found nothing in the kitchen except for the ingredients for dinner sitting on the counter, which appeared to have been sitting there all night. So, all these red flags aside, the thing that really made him uneasy was how silent and still the apartment was. That feeling of abandonment is what told him things were not right. So, from the kitchen, he went to the bedroom where nothing looked disturbed, which... it's what he kind of expected because his wife was a very neat person. What did give Joseph pause, though, was when he noticed what appeared to be a broken bar of soap on the floor. So he leaves his wife's room and heads to the adjacent room, slightly pushing the door open. Here he finds the nude, dead body of his daughter lying across the bed. And he didn't need to touch Ronnie to know that she was dead. By the time he had found her, she had begun to turn a slight blue tinge. There were visible dark bruises on her neck, and her eyes were wide open, staring lifeless at the ceiling above her.
Oh, damn.
So obviously horrified, he backed out of the room and went into the third bedroom of the apartment, hoping to find Mary there. Instead of Mary, he finds her boarder, Frank Burns, dead. Frank was found in his bed, covered by a blanket except for his head, which was covered and caked in blood. Joseph runs from the apartment, going downstairs to his daughter Ethel and her husband. When he got to the lobby, he began screaming, quote, "They're all dead. Murdered." The three return to the apartment. Ethel sits in the kitchen sobbing, while her husband and her father continue to search for Mary because they had no idea where she was.
Right.
You know, and they're like, what the fuck is going on? So Joseph thought that Mary maybe had went to the nearest police precinct for help. Like maybe she had returned home from somewhere, found Ronnie and Frank dead, and then ran to get help. So the three decided that Joseph would go to the precinct looking for Mary while Ethel and Joe would stay there and phone for the police. So detectives Martin Owens and William Gilmartin were the first to arrive shortly after receiving the call. Along with both bodies and what Joseph had noticed, they see that there are no signs of forced entry and no signs of a struggle. So they believe that the killer knew at least one of the victims, if not both, and had been willingly let into the apartment. They also believe that the attack was a surprise, which meant the victims didn't have a chance to fight back. From here, Detective Gilmartin entered Ronnie's room. He looks around, you know, as they do, and this is when he saw something sticking out from under the bed. He crouches down to see what it is, and here he finds the lifeless body of Mary Gideon. She was fully clothed, but it appeared that her underwear had been torn. Like Ronnie, she had been strangled. Less than an hour after the detectives arrived at the small apartment, it was packed with detectives, police officers, the district attorney, and a slew of photographers all tramping through the apartment and ultimately the crime scene. Because, you know, it's the 30s. There's pretty much no knowledge of the crime scene preservation. So anyone and everyone's just all up in here just touching every damn thing. So aside from that bar of soap that was on the floor that I told you about, nothing was disturbed. Ethel did notice that there was a small green alarm clock from Ronnie's dresser that was missing. But other than that, nothing appeared to be missing from the apartment at all. And there were valuables sitting right out in the open. So it was very clear from the very beginning of this that it was not a robbery gone wrong.
Right.
Someone went there with the intentions of killing someone in that apartment that day. So a preliminary examination of the bodies showed that Frank Burns died quickly and most likely while he was asleep. He had been laying on his side when the killer crept into his room and delivered 11 quick stabs to his head and neck with a long pointed weapon. They believed that this weapon was like an ice pick or something similar to that. They couldn't determine which order the stabs hit Frank, but the fatal one at the base of his skull, just below his foramen magnum, which this is where the spinal cord enters the skull and then connects to the brain. So this one would have killed him instantly if he wasn't already dead. It was later learned that Frank was deaf in one ear. And that night, he had been laying on his good ear, so he didn't hear when Ronnie, her mother, or the killer came in.
Of course.
Yep. So he couldn't do anything for them or himself. Both Mary and Ronnie had died of manual strangulation. It was said that the killer's hands had applied so much force that Mary's thyroid cartilage was torn, and Ronnie's throat showed signs of hemorrhaging in the larynx and the muscles of her neck.
They had been strong.
Oh, yeah. So Mary's knuckles showed defensive wounds. They were like really bad bruises, meaning that she had fought her killer hard. But in the end, it just wasn't enough. Though they wouldn't know until the actual autopsy was done, due to Ronnie being found nude and Mary's underwear being torn, they believed that one or both of them had been sexually assaulted. They wouldn't know until the autopsy, though. So unfortunately, aside from the missing alarm clock, the scene had very little evidence. which meant they had no leads. But there was one thing that investigators did find odd. So as soon as they arrived in the apartment, Tucci, Ronnie's dog, had been nonstop barking to the point where the ASPCA had to come and remove him from the apartment because they just couldn't do their jobs. So according to the neighbors, this happened anytime someone new or familiar to him came to the apartment. But none of them remembered hearing him bark at any time the night before. This supported their theory, and whoever was responsible for this triple homicide knew one or more of the victims and had been at the apartment before. Enough times that this dog recognized them and to be freely let into the apartment without fear. So investigators now hit the streets looking for any clues, but just like inside the apartment, it gave them nothing about the crime or who could have committed it. One man who lived two floors below the Gideons recalled hearing a scream around 11 p.m., followed by what sounded like a brief scuffle, but nothing after that. He said he wasn't sure what he had heard, so he stuck his head out the window to listen, but because he had heard nothing more, he went back to bed. Another neighbor reported that they had come home late that night, a little after 2 a.m., and he had noticed that the Gideon's door was slightly open. And as he walked past it, it slowly closed as if someone was behind the door where he couldn't see them pushing it shut. He said, quote, "I don't know. There was something about the way that door started to close that gave me the creeps. And I beat it to the sixth floor as fast as I could." It really amazes me, like, when shit like this happens. Like any kind of crime, really, that people are so shocked and appalled by what is coming out in the news that happened. But then it comes out that at least one damn person heard something and they just ignored it. Like, how? I'm sorry. How do you go back to sleep after you hear what you, it sounds like someone screaming? You just go back to sleep and sleep peacefully.
Like nothing happened.
Yeah. Like, obviously, you don't want to put yourself in harm's way, but don't ignore what you heard either. At the very least, call the police.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you got to follow your intuition. If something's not right, it's probably not right. Something gives you the creeps. Whoever's giving you the creeps is probably creepy. Like,
right.
Anyway. So while the apartment and neighbors yielded very few clues, detectives found Ronnie's diary, which they had hoped would offer some information to who could have done this. The diary contained a list of numbers and entries that dated back to 1932, each very detailed. The entries that were of most notice to the detectives were the ones that referenced someone that Ronnie had only referred to as letter B. As one of the detectives is flipping through the diary trying to figure out who B is, the phone in the kitchen rings. Detective Charlie McGowan, who was standing closest, picked up the receiver. The man on the other end asked to speak to Ronnie. McGowan identified himself and explained that she wasn't available, then asked for the man's name and address. This man was Stephen Butters, as in the letter B. So he told detectives that he had been out with Ronnie the night before. So thinking he could be the B that Ronnie referred to in her diary, they rushed over to Butters' apartment, which was a short distance away, and immediately brought him in for questioning. Neither the detective on the phone or the officers that had brought him in gave him any indication of what was going on. He had no idea why they wanted to speak to him, but once he got to the precinct, the slew of reporters crowded around the front entrance told him that something awful had happened. Once inside, he had met with Ethel, who told him what happened to Ronnie and the other two. From the moment Stephen sat down with detectives in the interrogation room, Detective Lyons and Commissioner Valentine could tell Stephen Butters was not their suspect. It was said that he was very distraught by the news of the murders, and he was scared of the veteran detectives who were now showering him with questions, and he appeared to be eager to help in any way that he could. According to Butters, his best friend Lincoln Hauser had gone out of town for the weekend and asked Stephen to keep an eye on his girlfriend Ronnie while he was away, because he had no other plans that weekend, and because who wouldn't want to be seen with a model, you know, walking around town, he agreed to it. Their original plans were that the two would meet up with one of Ronnie's other friends for dinner. But when Ronnie had arrived to Stephen's apartment a little before 8 p.m., she was alone and said that her friend had canceled. They decided to change plans, and instead, the two met up with one of Steven's friends for dinner at a local restaurant. They had some drinks, and then Steven's friend had left around 2 a.m. Him and Ronnie then went to Monte Carlo Bar and Grill for more drinks. He said he walked her home around 3 a.m., straight to her door on the fourth floor. They then made plans to attend Sunday Mass together at 10 a.m., then he left, walking to his own apartment. He returned to the Gideon's apartment at 10 a.m. on Sunday, just as they had planned, but there was no answer at the buzzer. So he went back home and tried to call a few times throughout the afternoon. And that was whenever the detectives, you know, heard the phone ring and all that. So detectives were convinced that he was telling the truth. And at around 9 p.m., they let Stephen go. And of course, as soon as he walked out of the station, reporters pounced on him, trying to get information, thinking that he was the one that had done it. You know, because you have any information to tell you that.
Right.
The next day, as investigators are digging more into Ronnie's past, the story of the murders hits the newspapers in a sensational way. In 1937, Americans are still feeling the crushing impact of the Great Depression, and they were welcoming to anything that could escape what they were living through. And the press delivered on that. Three people were murdered, and of course, investigators couldn't say which or if any of the victims was the primary target. But despite this, the press zeroed in on Ronnie, on her beauty and her career as a model. The New York Daily News dedicated their entire front page to a provocative photo of Ronnie with an inset photo, which is a smaller photo that's set, you know, alongside with larger. Mm-hmm. So they placed this provocative photo of Ronnie that completely covers the front page with an inset of a smaller photo of her lifeless body as she's being removed from the apartment with a headline that read, quote, three murders in model's flat. She opened the door for death.
What the fuck? Wow.
Yeah. There's two things wrong with this. First, it wasn't her flat. It was her mother's. She just slept there. Second, nobody knows who opened the door. If right. any of them opened the door. Like, the killer could have just walked right in because the door wasn't locked. Not only that, who doesn't open their door if someone knocks on it?
Yep.
Not every apartment has peepholes. You just open the door. Like, these papers, no morals or decency at all.
Mm-mm.
So in a lucid and dramatic way, the article detailed what they referred to as the murder of the artist model and two other murders. Yeah. Because apparently the other murders were less than.
Yeah, they didn't matter.
Yeah. They said without directly saying, like I said before, that Ronnie was the target and that Mary and Frank were simply collateral damage. They were saying, as a model, Ronnie was the only one that led any kind of life that would have caused this to happen. The Daily News reported, quote, as she stepped into the apartment, the killer was thought to have dragged Ronnie into the bathroom, throttling her and started ripping off her clothes. The dying beauty was borne to the room where her mother lay lifeless and thrown on the bed, end quote. Where are you getting your information from? Because aside from the bodies themselves, there's no sign of violence or any kind of struggle. The police had no fucking idea what happened. But the newspapers do, though.
Of course, they always do.
Yeah. Anything to sell a paper, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So nearly every article written was accompanied by pictures of Ronnie. Most of them were her modeling photos where she's in various states of undress. So they used these photos to boost their narrative, of course, and sell the papers because the story of a model being murdered under mysterious circumstances with no suspect in sight was too good for any press outlet to resist. Shortly after these articles started circulating, nearly every photographer that had ever shot photos of Ronnie come out of the woodworks in hopes of selling their photos of her to the highest bidder. Like, just fucking scavengers out here. Like, have some decency. What goes through one's brain? Like, let's exploit this tragedy for a payout.
Right. All about money.
Exactly. Get it the fuck together, people. Morals and standards. We're lacking in those areas, seriously. Anyway, that's a whole nother subject. So within days of the murders, the story had become solely about Ronnie. Fuck the other two. You know, they're not going to sell papers. We're only going to talk about the dead provocative model.
They're just forgetting the rest.
Yeah, exactly. Like, oh, she's the one that's going to bring us, you know, views and sales and shit. Fuck the other two. Like, I think that this is what makes me mad the most out of the whole thing. There were three victims. Three people were killed inside their home. And you're just, you're ignoring two of them. And you're dramatizing the whole fucking thing just so you can get a payout.
Yep.
The real story is awful enough. And you will see by the end of it. The real thing is awful enough. You do not need to dramatize it at all. Like, the real story does enough of that on its own. Okay, anyway, back on track.
Rant over.
Yeah. For now, anyway. The papers had a very noticeable misogynistic tone to their articles. They were basically blaming Ronnie for not only her death, but the death of her mother and Frey. And they did it before any actual facts were released by authorities. To the papers, Ronnie was just another low-class nude model with a diary filled with men's numbers. But for those that knew Ronnie, this wasn't farther from the truth. Although she was rebellious and went against the grain, anyone who met her loved her. The papers would never report this in their scandalous articles about Ronnie. And it only got worse when her own father slandered her in the press.
What?
Yeah. On March 30th, just one day after his wife and daughter were found dead, Joseph Gideon did an interview with the Daily News, and he told them that Ronnie made fools of lots of men, that one of them killed her with his wife and the boarder. In this interview, he continued with saying it was hard to say now, but Ronnie was wild and willful. He stated that girls Ronnie's age didn't realize it, but you can't treat men the way in which she did. He then gave an interview to a newspaper that was slandering his daughter, blaming her for the murders of all three victims. And instead of defending her, he leans into it and tells them they are right on placing the blame on his own daughter. Like, everyone grieves in their own way. Right, exactly.
Yeah, but damn.
Blaming your own child for her murder. What kind of grief process is that?
That's crazy.
Like, I don't understand what was going through his head to be able to stand there and be like, oh, this is her fault. Like,
she did it.
Yeah. I feel like he's a clear example of those that should not be allowed to reproduce, but just my opinion.
Exactly.
So, these people aren't telling men to not harm women. They're telling women, oh, you can't make a fool of men, because if you do, they'll come and kill you. How about we just don't kill people? Like,
right?
Just don't kill anybody. No matter the reason. Like, what the fuck is wrong with you? Yeah. So, while the press continues their campaign in slandering Ronnie, investigators were struggling to find any leads that would move the case forward. With the lack of evidence at the scene, no forced entry, and the fact that the dog never barked to alarm anyone, they believe the killer may have been a previous boarder. And within days of the murders, they identified 45-year-old chauffeur George Gray as their prime suspect. At the time that they identified this man, they also identified 20-year-old Mary Bacco as a person of interest. Gary had been a tenant of the Gideons when they lived on East 53rd Street, so their old apartment before Ethel got married. And Mary Bacco claimed to have been living with Mary and Ronnie as recent as a week before they were killed. Police detained Gary briefly, but they let him go a few hours later without giving any kind of explanation to the press on why. Which, they don't have to. They usually do. So it's odd, but they don't have to. So, at the very least, you know, they normally say, oh, he's clear, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so they said nothing. Other than when Chief Inspector John Lyons had told reporters that they had nothing to hang their hats on. So, it sounds like they cleared this guy. And then not long after that, Mary Bacco was cleared. So this entire case frustrated investigators, but they still had Ronnie's diary. They were convinced that the killer's identity was somewhere inside this diary. They just had to find it. From what they could tell, Ronnie had known the guy that she had referred to as B for at least a year. And within that year span, the relationship she had with B went from friendly to fearful. But she never said why she feared him. So they know she feared him because several entries made it clear that within the few weeks leading up to her death, she grew to strongly fear this man and worried that his behavior was going to escalate to violence. This lead was promising, but they had no idea who it was. So they turned back to Ronnie's life. And before long, they figure out that Ronnie's ex-husband's name was Bobby Flowers, as in Bobby with a B.
Right.
So in Flowers, he and Ronnie had gotten into a number of arguments while they were together. And a couple of them had gotten physical, but he swore that it was all in the past. It was true their relationship was over, but he said that wasn't because of animosity. They had just gotten married too young and for the wrong reasons. Because of this, they had decided that it was best that they part their ways civilly. Not only did his response make sense, but he also had an alibi for the night of the murders. He had been working as a hot dog vendor in a public location, so there were hundreds of people that saw him there. So Bobby Flowers is not the beat they were looking for. By March 30th, there were more than 200 NYPD officers assigned to this case. And dozens of potential witnesses and suspects had been interviewed, but none led to any viable leads. So now, rolling out Gary and confirming Bobby's alibi, they were back to square one. All they knew for sure was that at the very least, Ronnie's murder was one of passion, which, duh. So, in addition to this, they had since learned, despite what the papers were spewing, neither Ronnie or her mother had been sexually assaulted.
They weren't?
No.
Good.
Yep. It had just, for whatever reason, been staged to look that way.
Right.
But now they know that it was not a robbery gone wrong. It was not a sexually motivated crime. So they have no idea what the motive is.
I don't either.
So if not Ronnie's ex-husband, her friend that she was with that night, or Butters, who up till now were the most likely suspects, who could have been so angry with Ronnie that they would have wanted her dead? In the absence of any suspects left, detectives turned back to the person that reported the crime in the first place. The person that found the bodies. None other than the father and husband of two of the victims, Joseph Gideon. It seems like Detectives Owen and Gilmore, they were just kind of suspicious of Joseph from the very beginning. I mean, look at how he's acting.
Right.
When the two arrived at the apartment, right after they got the call about the murders, they took notice of his behavior at the scene, which they said was odd, to say the very least. And I can't really say I don't agree. Unlike Ethel and her husband, who were visibly shaken and upset, Joseph seemed unbothered. So now, we can't gauge someone's guilt based off how they act, okay? Especially in a traumatic situation like this. We all know that Joseph did find his youngest daughter dead. He found a boarder in the house dead. So he could be in shock. It's odd, but that does not mean he's guilty. Okay, we all handle things like that differently. But then, Joseph gave those interviews where he slandered his daughter and spoke candidly about his wife and their separation. This raised the suspicion that investigators had regarding his involvement even more. Can't blame him. So, kind of seems like investigators are grasping at straws. With no evidence or leads, they're desperate for anything. Desperate to close out this case and put a name to the killer. And Joseph's odd, unbothered behavior, along with his statements to the press, made him the perfect person to zero in on. But there's also something they found that I haven't told you about yet.
Oh, great.
The only piece of evidence left at the scene, and on the surface, paired with Joseph's behavior and his public statements, points directly at him as the most likely suspect. As always, a preliminary examination of the bodies was conducted. And like I said, they really didn't find much besides the bruising and defensive wounds. Following this, the autopsies of all three bodies were conducted. During this, they confirmed the cause and manner of death for all three victims. They dispelled the belief of sexual assault on either woman, as I said before. But what I didn't tell you is that on Ronnie's body, they found several gray hairs.
What?
Yep. And they believed these hairs came from the killer. And can you guess who had gray hair?
Her dad.
Yes. Joseph Gideon had a head full of gray hair. So, In their initial interview with Joseph, he claimed that the night of the murders, he went to a bar that was around the corner from his upholstery shop. He said he was there drinking and playing skee ball until around 2 a.m. Detectives checked this out, of course, and the bartender did, in fact, remember Joseph being there, telling the detectives that he had actually gotten the high score for skee ball that night. And the score was recorded on the board. But he didn't recall seeing Joseph around closing time, which was around 2. So this meant that, yeah, Joseph was there when he said he was, but there wasn't anyone that could confirm he left when he said he did. So he could have possibly left before 2 a.m., went to the apartment, killed them, and then went home. So on April 1st, with nowhere else to turn, detectives go to Joseph's upholstery shop to ask him more questions. They confront him with what the bartender told him, but he stuck to his story, telling them the bartender was mistaken and that he was there until closing. While one detective was questioning Joseph, the other one was looking around the shop. And this was when they came across Joseph's upholster's kit sitting on the counter. Which, he's an upholster, so duh, yeah, he's going to have one of these.
Right.
And of course, it's going to be sitting on the counter. Like, duh. So, this kit obviously included everything that an upholster would need. Had several large needles, and the largest, which closely resembled an ice pick, was missing. This, coupled with his odd behavior, his shaky alibi, his clear and outright rage and anger against his daughter, and the fact that he had a pistol in his possession without a permit, made him a pretty good suspect. So they took him back to the precinct for further questioning. Joe still stuck to his story. He kept telling him, "This is what I did that night." He even offered up his own theory to who the killer was. Joseph said, quote, "A millionaire from Boston had been infatuated with Ronnie and had vainly offered her a car and an apartment and some money. And when she rebuffed his advances, he became frustrated and hired someone to kill her." So this claim of Joseph's isn't new. He had apparently told detectives this the day that they were found. So he'd been throwing this thing around from the very beginning. They weren't really paying any kind of attention to it because they looked into this claim. And they had already ruled it out. So they're like, "Sure, guy. You say so." So by the end of the day, on April 1st, spokesperson for the precinct announced that Joseph, quote, would be arraigned on a formal charge sometime before morning. However, by the morning of April 2nd, he had not been arrested or charged for any crime. He was just kind of just chilling there. But finally, before the day ended on April 2nd, Joseph was charged with possession of an unlicensed gun. It's a minor charge, but with it, they were able to hold him and question him further. So now that he's in their custody and can't leave the interrogation room on his own, they interrogate him intensely. They don't allow him to sleep for nearly 33 hours. They deny him food, and even go as far as threatening and physically assaulting him.
Jesus.
But by the time they were done, his story was the same. Nothing changed from what he had originally told detectives. So now we have an old internet sleuth enter our story before internet and sleuths were a thing. Convinced that police weren't doing enough to find the killer, True Detective Magazine's editor, which was the magazine that Ronnie had modeled for, had sent a writer to Joseph's building to ask neighbors if any of them had seen Joseph come or go that night. This wasn't the only time that they had gotten involved in the case either. When newspapers were slandering Ronnie, they took to the press, publishing a full-page editorial combating the lies about Ronnie and expressing to everyone that picked up their magazine what kind of person Ronnie truly was, showing that she was so much more than a provocative photo in a magazine. It's not clear how much this editorial had affected the case, but the second go-around were proved to be very impactful. So the True Detective writer only had to knock on a few doors before he found someone that said he had definitely seen Joseph Gideon come home drunk around 3 a.m. the night of the murders, which meant Joseph Gideon was innocent. He had not killed his daughter, his wife, or Frank. With this neighbor confirming Joseph's alibi, and after 2 days of brutal and illegal interrogation tactics, he was released from custody on April 3rd. According to the press, after this release, he, quote, had numerous black and blue spots, swelling, cuts, and abrasions on his face and head. His lawyer further claimed that Joseph had been kicked, pulled, dragged, and slapped for hours. May not have been the best dad, and he definitely made some questionable choices in all this, but guilty or not, no one should go through that.
Right.
Like, it's disgusting. So now, having lost their prime suspect, they were right back to where they began, with nothing. Despite this, Detective Walter Harding told reporters, quote, there are four or five different angles we're working on now, and we've cleared these up. Once we've cleared these up, we'll have a complete and direct case. No. No, sir. That's nowhere near the truth. They had no idea who the killer was, and they were no closer to catching who did it than they were on day one. So they go back to Ronnie's diary, which by this time, they had still not read all the way through. I feel like that would have been the first thing that I did.
Right. Read the whole thing.
Yeah. They're just kind of flipping through it and picking shit. This go around of going through it, they discovered an entry where Ronnie had made it clear that no matter how she may have or have not felt about this mysterious bee man, his attention was clearly and solely on her sister, Ethel. According to what Ronnie wrote in her diary the weeks leading up to the murders, she had been concerned that he had become obsessed with Ethel and that he may do something irrational to Ethel. Now knowing this, detectives went to her and asked her if she knew who the man that Ronnie had been calling B could have been. And everyone was surprised when Ethel told detectives she knew exactly who her sister was talking about, and she knew him very well. In fact, her entire family did. This man's name was Robert Bob Irwin, who was a former boarder of Mary's and had become infatuated with Ethel. But according to Ethel, he had moved out and left the area after she had rejected his romantic advances and married Joe Kuttner instead. And that's where we're going to end for part one.
Oh, shit.
Yep.
It's getting good.
Oh, yeah, I know. The beginning part of it's like there's a lot, but it all matters.
Right.
Yep. So part two will be next Monday. And we'll dive into Robert Bob Irwin.
Should be interesting.
And we'll see if they figure this case out.
Right.
All right. That's all I got for this one.
Can't wait to hear the rest.
It'll be Easter by the time we come back. So hopefully everyone has a good Easter. Yay.
Easter.
Okay. So we'll be back next week for another episode, part two of this one. As always, the photos can be found on Facebook page. That is in the link for this episode. That link is in our episode description. Make sure you give us a rate and a review. Those help us out. Don't forget to subscribe so you get those notifications when new episodes are released. We hope you keep listening and remember to
watch for monsters
and don't kill people. Bye, y'all.
Bye, y'all.